Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your 26 trillion streams of music, news, and criticism. We believe in its value. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Yeah, I know. She's still the background on your phone. And I know. Takes time to get someone out your mind. But you don't give me any signs. And I told you all the passwords to mine. And I'll admit, I haven't been completely faithful. It was way back in April. We didn't have a label. Yeah, I tried to play cool. Cause we're never really stable. It's never ever able to figure out. Keep waiting for the right time. Why you keep me on the sideline? I'm sick of all this trying. While I watch you drift further away. It's like I have you, but I don't really have you.
That is Sideline by Naya, which we are playing, yes, because it was on my top 10 albums of 2017, but also because this week is the Listener Mailbag edition. This is our second Listener Mailbag. We're going to try to do one of these every 3 or 4 months. But this is the year-end Listener Mailbag. And the first question actually touches on Naya. Karen Gans, our pop music editor, is on vacation this week, so she is not with us.
Staycation.
That's true. It is a staycation.
As far as I know, she was in yesterday.
I think there was some home repair involved today. Yeah. Like, I think there were some shouts to Karen and her home repair. I'm joined by the pop music crew of the New York Times. We're going to answer all your questions to the best of our abilities, or at least halfway there. To my left, Joe Coscarelli, pop music reporter.
I'm here.
Sitting across table, special guest of the podcast this week, Ben Cesari, music business reporter.
Hi.
Chief pop music critic John Perales to my right.
Hi there. Hope you're enjoying the stereo.
Yes, that's true. A lot of stereo, a lot of action. I want to be in both your eardrums today. Ben is going to be here to help us, especially with the business-oriented questions, because we got a bunch of business-oriented questions in addition to a lot of weird, like, why isn't Fergie more famous? Like, we'll get to that.
Conceptual questions.
Yeah, like, it's not a business question.
No, maybe. It could be. We'll get to the Fergie question, I promise. But the first question is from Henry Goldman. Henry asks, one of the most constant questions I have as a fan of music, especially music that doesn't have massive mainstream audiences, are the artists I like generating enough revenue to keep making music full time? I'm thinking about known critically acclaimed artists, but whose top songs on Spotify are in the low seven figures, like a Naya or an Open Mic Eagle. Shouts to Open Mic Eagle. A scale where they have real audience, but they're not making much off the trickle they generate from streaming, YouTube revenue, iTunes buys, etc. Beyond licensing, touring, and merchandise, and maybe Bandcamp, was there a way in 2017 that artists made money that surprised you all or moved you? What do you see for 2018? Are we going to see artists constantly tweeting about joining their Patreon, although Patreon apparently has some problems,
yeah,
or something else?
Wow.
So, Ben, artist revenue, full-time artist, and full-time indie music making. How viable is that in this particular moment?
That's the big question. I think it's still viable. For the stars, they are making money from the streaming. But as the reader pointed out, Henry, it's still kind of questionable when it comes to anything that's not superstar level.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still lawsuits flying around about the licensing on streaming, so that's not totally worked out. But the question was, has anything surprised me about new models for how people make their money? I feel like I'm going to wake up in the middle of the night and remember something, but
okay.
I got to say no. But okay. I think that, like, the money that comes in from the different kinds of streaming and then vinyl sales and other sort of physical stuff,
sure,
that's really shaping up to be actually a pretty sizable, you know, niche chunk of the business. And then touring and T-shirts.
Still, I mean, touring. It's always been touring, right?
I feel like increasingly merch is more and more of a piece, although obviously a lot of major label artists have signed away a bunch of their merch money.
Yeah.
But I think merch, I mean, has always been important for smaller artists, but I feel like the mechanisms for merch distribution are much more seamless now than they ever have been.
When I was reporting my story on Quality Control, the rap label in Atlanta, I was around for a call that they made, you know, with Trippie Redd, who is a burgeoning SoundCloud rapper, now moved up to a major label, but is still operating semi-independently, and he had just dropped like a capsule collection of his sort of crew merch.
Who among us really hasn't, to be fair?
And he only advertised it on his Instagram story, not even on his Instagram itself, but he very quickly rang up five figures in selling basically t-shirts and hoodies off of his Instagram story. So, I mean, I think if you have a diehard fan base and you're sort of scarce in terms of your merchandise, that's definitely a play. And then, you know, they were basically, his managers were trying to turn that into a deal with one of these companies like Bravado, which does merch through
major labels.
And then, you know, they confront you a lot of money and then you make it back for them.
So. I think this year is one where we really saw like the convergence of social media and streaming and those other kind of like ancillary type things like coming together. And when you think about like Cardi B kind of being like an Instagram star and a TV star and then like number one song.
Sponsored posts. And that seems like a revenue stream.
SoundCloud reposts.
SoundCloud reposts.
SoundCloud reposts. Yo, should we just get a SoundCloud just so we can charge people to repost?
Yes. Do you know about this? Artists charge people to repost their songs onto their popular SoundClouds?
Anything for a buck.
Anything for a buck.
Also, the thing that was in Kay's story about Quality Control, how Lil Yachty was on Twitch.
The video game live streaming service.
And getting people to pay him to fart on Twitch. So, like, that's, I guess, an alternative revenue stream, although I don't know how many people that will work for.
Or critique their songs. I think he was critiquing people's songs.
For $500. That seems like...
Is that what you do?
Literally? That pay better than my actual job if I just had a Twitch and critique songs for $500?
I think you have to have 4 million followers to make that work.
Yeah, big Yachty, yeah. Super Yachty. So, do you think that Patreon and systems like that are actually well equipped for music makers? They don't necessarily seem, unless you have a significant fan base that's kind of already cooked into expecting stuff from you, I don't know if it's so useful for like a young on the rise person.
True, but I think once they get to a certain level, it will be. I mean, you're right that like it's the whole model of it is to like get a community of a certain size to support you. But I feel like communities can rise pretty fast these days and like they can go from Instagram to something else.
Yeah. I mean, remember the wave of Kickstarter mm-hmm. albums, which has died off a little bit, I think. But, you know, Amanda Palmer making $1 million to fund her album, or, you know, Ted Leo made an album this year off of Kickstarter, TLC, you know, it exists. But yeah, these people still have name brand recognition before they go to the platform where they're going to make the money.
Like, obviously, YouTube-level creatives obviously have all sort of, like, what we would think of as low-level monetization options, like, whether it's a Twitch or things like that. Do you feel, like, when I saw that Lil Yachty did that in that story, I was like, it's a little bit beneath Yachty. But do you think at a certain point, the things that we think of as, like, monetization systems that are beneath traditional celebrities are not, we're not going to think of them in those terms anymore? It's just going to be part of, I'm a famous person, so, like, you're a famous person, so you're making money in all these places that don't seem hierarchically that cool to me right now.
I think corporations are still going to run famous people for a while.
Shouts to corporations.
I don't know. Just
I feel like the bar has been gradually lowering on that for a long time. And things like sponsored posts, like it was, I don't know. I felt like it was pretty hard to imagine that even a few years ago, that would just become an ordinary part of the online world.
Even for actual famous people.
Yeah.
You don't hear the phrase selling out too often anymore.
Right. It doesn't exist.
That's true. That's the bottom line here.
Ben, do you think from from songwriters and creators, when we think about how much money they make through streaming services, what can you tell us a little bit about the bigger picture conversations that are being had as far as better remuneration for creators through those systems in the coming years?
There's a lot of worry out there.
You think that's going to get worse?
I think it's probably not going to get better.
Really?
Yeah.
It's a 1%.
I mean, I think like the overall numbers are going to get bigger, but I think like their slice of the pie, I'm sorry to say, and I hope I'm wrong, but I don't see it changing dramatically. The more power like Spotify has, the more they've been able to negotiate their rates down for everything. Mm-hmm. So they're now paying the record labels a little bit less than they did a year ago for the content. And the reason is you're making a slightly smaller piece of a bigger and growing pie. So that's the way the deals have been going. And I think the songwriters and the organizations on their behalf, and like ASCAP and BMI and some of those kind of groups and the publishers, have been fighting really hard. I think like on a moral level, they have a very strong argument of like, give us credit for what we do and pay us in a way that is fair. But I don't feel like that has really moved forward a lot. And the way the publishing industry works with splits and all that stuff, there's more songwriters involved in a song, so they might be getting a smaller slice of it. And then if somebody threatens to sue because your song sounds a little bit like one from 34 years ago, and you have to cut them in for 10%
more songwriters
and pay your lawyer off, like that kind of stuff is becoming more just sort of part of the everyday business.
Yeah, and interesting, this ties into another question, which we'll get into right now. This is coming from Chris Klein, whose first question is unanswerable.
Why is Jadakiss as hard as it gets? Why is the industry?
Why is Jadakiss as hard as it gets? But Chris wants to know, will another competitor, Amazon Music, YouTube's revamped music platform coming next year, which has a name that I can't remember right now.
Remix.
Hi, shouts to Lior.
Why is Jadakiss as hard as it gets?
Yeah, seriously, I'm just...
The why remix.
Is there a way to communicate on the podcast how much I'm smiling right now, how high my cheekbones are? YouTube remix, Google Music, disrupt the race between Apple Music and Spotify in 2018.
I think it's possible, especially when there are names that are that big.
Mm-hmm.
I think
How could they do it? Let's talk about it in two different ways. How could they do it in a way that's friendlier to artists? Like, say, SoundCloud has been successful because it's friendlier to artists. How can they do it also in a way that's friendlier to consumers?
I think that the way they're going to do it is by shoving it in your face.
Okay.
You know, I don't think that you succeed necessarily by being friendly in this kind of environment, you
right.
know? Mm-hmm. And like, we are in an age of giants, and I don't want to necessarily say the M word of monopoly, but...
Oligopoly?
Sure, oligopoly. Duopolies, triopolies.
Shouts to all my young opolies out there.
The reason that Apple was able to very suddenly, over just a year or two, I mean, it's now 3 years old, but was able to very quickly become such a force is because they are Apple.
And if, just put it on your phone.
Yeah, it's on your phone already. So I feel that the giants of Silicon Valley can kind of force themselves into our consciousness. Whether they will ultimately like unseat Spotify, who knows? I mean, the thing for Spotify that's on the horizon is an IPO. They've grown so much and they've become such a part of just the music industry itself. Like, they are radio to some extent now, right? Like, that is where hits happen. They've made themselves into, like, in a way, the biggest player there, but they could get swallowed up too. You know,
Who would buy them?
Google, Facebook, Amazon, and somebody. Mm-hmm. I mean,
Disney,
Spotify,
21st Century Fox. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, Jimmy Iovine was talking about this in an interview recently where he was saying, like, you know, Spotify is the only, like, standalone out there, and that kind of makes them vulnerable.
Yeah.
Like, if you're Apple, you can afford to sort of stumble a little bit, lose a little money. You know, Facebook has supposedly been working on some kind of music streaming service. I think when it comes to just, like, where are you going to listen to the Ed Sheeran song, I think the giants have a lot of ability to just sort of muscle their way in. But when it comes to, like, who's going to create the next Lil Uzi, I don't think there's a lot of contenders out there. I think it's like SoundCloud and YouTube have really built that into a whole sort of universe of like where kids go to make music and listen to music and find music.
So the follow-up question would be for me, do you think SoundCloud will survive 2018?
In our hearts.
I mean, you know, like, Vine is still in my heart. You know, like, there's plenty of outmoded platforms that remain in my heart. But do you think that it has a business strategy or a set, like, an industry relevance that will allow it to continue to thrive or at least, you know, hang on by its fingertips?
It has industry relevance. I mean, this was the year they almost died.
Yeah.
And they got an infusion of equity money.
Just if we remind everybody, Chance the Rapper saying, quote, I'm working on the SoundCloud thing.
Yeah.
So shouts to Chance.
Who hasn't put a song on SoundCloud in a minute.
He did put one right away.
He did put one.
So I guess that's working on the SoundCloud thing. Maybe he meant I'm putting work on the SoundCloud thing. Anyway.
I mean, they have new management. They have a bunch of new investment.
Yeah.
They haven't really announced anything radically different yet. I believe they're going to want to invest more into the creator side of things, like maybe make it an even better place to put your remixes and stuff.
Yeah.
But that's part of what kind of got them into the fix that they were in the first place, that they were amazingly good at something that really didn't make money.
Yeah.
And then when they got into the side of the business that makes the money, they were clobbered by the other players that were better at it.
Right, because no one is paying for the premium SoundCloud service. That's
no one
thing.
I know.
Right. Is there a universe where someone buys them and they get not folded into a Spotify or an Apple Music, but they're basically made part of a larger ecosystem? They're kind of like the minor leagues side by side with the major league?
Absolutely.
So do you think they're a worthwhile acquisition target?
Yes, I do. And I think that's one possible scenario for them.
Okay.
I think they could struggle as a standalone, but that doesn't mean that, you know, they can't make it. But it's going to be tough. Pandora, in a way, is kind of in the same situation. And this is a multi-billion dollar publicly listed company. They were having severe money problems and they got a big investment from SiriusXM. And it's still minority, but the read on that is like SiriusXM is going to gradually assert more and more control. And that one possible end for Pandora is they simply become an arm of Sirius. So, I mean, in a way, Pandora is one of the biggest and most successful digital music companies, but they were also very vulnerable. Wall Street kind of wasn't liking what they saw. And, you know, the wolves came for them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like digital media is a pretty vulnerable business for any kind of digital media. And it's really hard to make it work. And if the investors start to get a little nervous about things,
yeah,
like the bottom can fall out fast.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it gets like scary, but also really interesting. You know, if you're someone like me watching it,
right,
not getting so paid by it.
Yeah, I was going to say, not so much if you're waiting on a check.
Right.
But to me, you have to wonder if all of these major players realize that you need those tiny little experimental spaces.
Yeah.
You need a SoundCloud. I mean, you need
Bandcamp.
Where are you going to generate the new talent? And
I don't think if you drive
these guys out of business.
Yeah.
I mean, what happens to that SoundCloud archive? What happens to that Bandcamp archive?
Yeah,
that would be scary.
That stresses me out.
I mean, I want UNESCO to have those. I really do.
I totally agree.
But, I mean, the way—
Shouts to anyone who's listening who's in digital archiving, please email me.
I want to talk
to y'all about Vine and SoundCloud. Okay, thanks.
I mean, the way that Google and all of Silicon Valley goes is just that they do want to subsume everything. Like, Facebook wants to be the platform for absolutely everything that happens in your life. And as long as it's digital, there's like no obstacle for that to actually happen. You know, they could put all the video in the world, all the comments in the world, all the news in the world could be, you know, could become part of Facebook. So I don't know. I mean, I agree with you that you need the margins of the business and of the culture. And you also need people like taking the risk and like not being able to subsist on selling iPhones in order to make the business work. And I mean, I feel like that's always going to happen, right? Like somebody will come up with a cool idea somewhere down the line, but that's like the risk we face with digital culture all the time.
Yeah. The ephemerality of it, obviously, but also that, you know, Facebook for all its kind of urge to subsume can be an unwelcoming place if you are existing in a marginal life, you know, a marginal or non-traditional creative approach or lifestyle. And so sometimes you need secondary or tertiary programming or spaces in order for people to feel like they have an actual creative outlet. And so that's why I agree, JP, like it stresses me out when I think of stuff like that just disappearing. And Popcast is pro net neutrality. Not that it means anything on this particular day, but we are pro net neutrality. Okay, let's play a new song, and then this will be the last question for Ben Cesario, but it involves the streaming ecosystem. So let's listen to a very bad song called Meant to Be by BB REXA and Florida Georgia Line.
Baby, lay on back and relax. Kick your pretty feet up on my dash. No need to go nowhere fast. Let's enjoy right here where we at. Who knows where this road is supposed to lead? We got nothing but time. Won't you ride?
ride with me, ride with me. See where this thing goes. If it's meant to be, it'll be, it'll be. Baby, if it's meant to be.
I don't mean to be so uptight, but my heart's been hurt a couple times by a couple guys that didn't treat me right. I ain't gonna lie, I ain't gonna lie. Cause I'm tired of the fake love. Show me what you're made of. Boy, make me believe.
Whoa, hold up, girl. Don't you know you're beautiful? And it's easy to see.
If it's meant to be, it'll be, it'll be. Baby, just let it be. If it's meant to be, it'll be, it'll be. Baby, just let it be. So won't you ride?
Okay, so maybe you like that song. I don't know. Maybe you're a strange person and you like that song. I find that song not that exciting. However, at this current moment, that song is the number one song on the Billboard country music charts. And it is apparently, and this is not verified, but the question says this, so I'm just going to go with it, the first solo female with a debut song to top the Billboard country singles charts.
How is it count as a solo song?
If technically,
it's Bebe Rexha with
Florida Georgia Line. And Florida Georgia Line, the first 45 seconds of the song are Florida Georgia Line. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these are all weird qualifications. However, this is a thing that more
this is
the
a country
point,
song.
This is happening. Yeah. This is a thing that is happening. And this is a question from Michael DeCaro. Michael wrote a long, like, 9-paragraph email, which I'm not going to read. But in essence, what Mike wants to know is what's up with gaming the charts? That's what I think, Mike. And if I'm misrepresenting you, I apologize. But in essence, what Mike is saying is, how did it take someone like this with a song like this? How come no other young female country singer-songwriter is able to top the Billboard Country Chart? And in essence, it's because no one else is gaming the system like this. I've got to assume that this song does well on streaming. Bebe Rexha works in a lot of pop and pop-affiliated spaces, so she's probably playlisted to death. Let's talk about gaming the charts.
I have a big picture thing that I think this represents, which is that it's become very clear this year that streaming is dominated by hip-hop and R&B.
Yep.
And then secondarily by what I think of as Spotify core pop, right? Which is like vaguely electronic, usually female vocals. Those are the things that stream the best, that have the highest streaming numbers in general. There are exceptions, but those things reliably stream a ton. And I think other genres like rock, and
country.
Like country that do not stream as well have started to realize, and the artists as well, that if they want to be big streamers, they need to get involved with some of these people who are really good at
spaces.
It. So Bebe Rexha is sort of a secret weapon for any country group like Florida Georgia Line, who is as far as country goes, gets streamed a ton.
Yeah.
But never like Post Malone numbers. So for them to get a Bebe Rexha on their song, that automatically gets them a higher look on Spotify. And I bet you that on the Spotify playlist, I don't know this, but I bet you that song got very good placement on like today's top hits and all those new music playlists.
And also, I think I don't use Spotify this way, but I imagine other people do. If you're into Bebe Rexha and you go to the Bebe Rexha page, this pops up. Like clicking through when there's 5 different artists on the song, you can click through a thing you can do on Spotify that you can't do on another music service. You click through and go to that person's page and the songs will end up on their playlist. So if you just want a Bebe Rexha playlist and you're already listening to Spotify core Bebe Rexha, then you'll also get country Spotify core Bebe Rexha.
And another example of this, I think, is low key, one of the biggest songs of the year is Coldplay and the Chainsmokers.
True.
And Coldplay would not have a huge hit in 2017 unless they were on a fake EDM song, even though it mostly just sounds like a Coldplay song.
But then how do you explain Sam Smith?
White people love Sam Smith. I don't know.
White people. JP, how was Sam Smith at Jingle Ball?
He was actually the best thing there.
Really?
Mm. Yeah, but because, I mean, to me anyway.
Did the children love him or did they leave?
Did they go to the bathroom?
No, people were into him. People were listening. I mean, he didn't get the screams that, you know, Taylor got.
Right.
But he actually seemed, I mean, it's a horrible format to actually make an artistic statement.
Right. Two songs or three songs and out.
By the time he was midway through the first song, you know, it was like everybody was heartbroken. It was great.
Mm-hmm. He's an anomaly to me. I don't know why Sam Smith streams as well as he does.
Yeah. It's been fascinating to see it, though. I mean, I agree with you completely about what you said. And, like, they're scratching each other's backs there. But the question is, like, what's up with gaming, the streaming? Why is that happening?
Well, not why is it happening, but basically, are we going to see more? I mean, I feel like I know why it's happening. But, like, when I checked, so I got this question. And to be fair, I had not listened to this song because I saw the song listed in Billboard. I assumed I wouldn't like it, and I didn't listen to it like a sour person.
You snob.
I know. But I'm just being honest.
I thought you were an open-minded critic.
I thought I was, too, until I saw Bebe Rexha and Florida Georgia Line next to each other. But then I listened to it, and I thought it was very, very, very bad. but then I was like, oh, I'm going to look and see where this is on the country airplay chart. And on country airplay, it was only like 46 or 42.
Which means country radio.
Country radio
is
not dealing with this record at
all.
They're
playing it once a week at 3 in the morning.
Right. So it makes me think how many other charts are going to get gamed like this? Because I don't know.
Every single one.
I don't know if the splits. Their Billboard's constantly refining its chart formulas. I don't know if the splits in a country chart are different than the splits in the pop charts or in the hip hop charts.
I would bet that radio is worth a lot on the country chart.
Right, but that means how crazy must this song be streaming if it's number 40 something on radio, but number one on overall hot. But you think more of this is going to happen?
Absolutely. I mean, I think like this is the new music business. Like this is the new $50 handshake. It's with the radio stations. I mean, I don't mean to imply anything illegal there. But gaming the system, like gaming the formula.
Tell me more, John.
Make it rain, John.
$80 handshake right now on the table.
Just saying. Say whatever you want to say.
I mean, if radio was the old platform that had to be conquered at all costs, Spotify and other streaming services, but mostly Spotify, are the new platform. And I think the way you do it now is with, like, search engine optimization.
Yeah, essentially.
And
it's just putting together big names.
And big names and also working those charts. I mean, I do this too where I just, like, poke around and find a couple of charts and look at it and see number 7 and go, and they've got me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I listen to number 7, I listen to number 8, I listen to number 9, I listen to number 10, and then my phone rings and I forget about it. But, like, they got me for those 4 songs.
What's really amazing to me is when the streaming behemoths combine with each other, like Post Malone putting out a Rockstar remix with Ozuna and Nicki Jam. Is that what it is? I think it'll be out by the time this podcast is out.
Turning
but basically,
this podcast into a little Uzi vert.
Only people could see what I'm seeing right now. Yeah. But John Caramonica stuffing money into his shirt.
That's right. That's
Post
right.
Malone, who's the streaming king, and then Latin Pop, which is having a huge streaming moment.
Right.
And they're like, why don't we just put it all together and make it one thing?
But
nobody's asking for it artistically, but
I am.
No, but it's search engine optimization. It's like anybody searching for any of those people goes to that song.
Yep. Right.
And then clicks on it and maybe hates it, but they got that click.
I don't think it's just search engine optimization. I think it's also the algorithms and mechanisms that happen there where, like, you know, if you're listening to the Post Malone song, maybe Spotify spits out another one that people who like that song also like this one. And so it's the network effect of those, like, you know, search terms and data points and whatever underneath the surface that you never see.
But there's also an internal flaw with some of the chart calculations. And this moment reminds me a lot of something. And it's when this song topped the Billboard Hip Hop Singles chart.
Oppan Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Oppan Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Oppan Gangnam Style.
Needs no introduction.
Yes. So y'all know what that was. So when Gangnam Style came out, Billboard charts reacted by putting it on the hip hop. I mean, they classified it as hip hop and it immediately went to number one on the Billboard hip hop chart. And this was a real struggle for everybody because obviously it's not a conventional hip hop song, even though it is a song with rapping. And so I think what you're seeing with the Bebe Rexha song, even though Florida Georgia Line is on it, is you're seeing this sort of classification issue that's underneath a lot of this. Whereas if you say something's country, and you can game the country chart. The country chart was vulnerable in the same way that the hip hop chart was vulnerable to something as sort of out of the blue as K-pop and as out of the blue as Gangnam Style.
I think this is only possible on electronic platforms like this, where like it, you couldn't game the country radio station.
Right.
You know, you couldn't game the hip hop station to playing some totally crazy thing that they would never like normally, right? But just the way it's kind of angled into that channel online is easy to do.
Well, it's human curation versus machine curation. Mm-hmm. And machines can be fooled.
Okay. Ben Cesario, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time. Thanks for bringing your expertise to podcast this week.
Thank you.
And happy holiday.
I'll take that $80 now.
This was actually not, though. This is a fashion.
It's an accessory.
Yes, this is an accessory. Now let me see your
milkshake.
Okay, so that was Hidden Hero of 2017, Fergie. That was MILF money or MILF dollar sign, depending on who's doing the saying. A lot of people, you know, I'd love to attribute this question to just one person, but I got to be honest and say a lot of people had Fergie questions. There's a lot of Fergie questions. Mostly want to know why Fergie was not hitting in 2017. Now, as some podcast listeners know, I was a quiet fan of the Fergie record.
Super quiet. Except on a couple podcasts.
Yes, I never actually wrote about it.
Yeah, but right, that's what I meant.
I'm a super quiet fan of the Fergie record. And mostly the songs on the Fergie record that I really liked are what would be deemed in 2017 probably the more problematic ones.
The rap songs.
The rapping songs. I think Fergie has sort of honed, in a way that Iggy Azalea has not, Fergie has kind of honed
Speaking of people who didn't hit in 2017.
Not hitting at all. Fergie has honed this thing of white female rapping that knows that it's not skilled. I think the Iggy Azalea kind of cognitive dissonance comes in the sort of that tension between trying to be skilled and not actually being skilled.
And the black scent.
That, yes, clearly. Whereas Fergie, I think, is not grappling with the same set of problems and therefore is maybe liberated a little bit. So I liked these Fergie songs, but this album fizzed. Did anybody else on this table have an opinion on Fergie, or is this just a strictly John Caramonica question?
You're a solo act.
Yeah, I watched this was a visual album, let's not forget. So I watched maybe like seven of the videos.
Shouts to Joe for watching seven Fergie videos.
They were played for us in the office by a publicist.
Okay, but shouts to Joe for being kidnapped.
But then I also watched some on my own. It's not horrible. I just didn't have any use for it.
I'm surprised in a playlist era that these songs didn't do better. I'm looking on Fergie's Spotify right now, and her number one song on Spotify is still Fergalicious.
Yeah, I mean, as it should be. I think the problem with Fergie is that she sort of got saddled with this novelty, sort of like semi-ironic fandom. Like, that's her millstone, you know? Like, and I just think it's been impossible for her to outrun that, no matter how good the music is.
Do you also think that, like, we are in an era that's, like, far too sincere for a Fergie to thrive?
That could be true.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
I just think it's really hard out here for a female rapper. And, you know, even...
I don't think Cardi B would agree with
you. Well, I was going to say, I think, you know, even the most successful female rapper of recent years, Nicki Minaj, didn't have the easiest time this year. Some of her solo singles came and went quite quickly.
You said it, Joe. All the barbs at Joe Coscarelli.
You know, I'm just stating facts. So, you know, I don't know. I think it's a difficult landscape for non-Cardi B female rappers.
Who has other streams of attention.
Exactly.
Shouts to Fergie, though. I still mess with this album, at least the rap songs. I really hope you continue to make these records to provide podcast fodder for years to come. Okay, we got a number of questions that are about serious topics. We're serious people. We're going to address these serious topics. This one's coming from L. Hunt. Long time, first time. Good opening. Thanks, L. happy to have you. What is the panel's thoughts on the widespread condemnation of Taylor Swift for her silence on Trump? It seemed to me to have far more of an impact on her public image and critical assessment of her album this year than the apparent duplicitousness revealed, or not revealed, whatever, in the Kim Kardashian Snapchat receipts saga. Does the global turbulence of the past 12 to 18 months mean it is no longer tenable for pop stars of her standing to be without public politics? And if so, what does it say about pop music?
You know, I think this came up again today because there was a Billboard headline that was just a quote from an Instagram caption she
wrote. Yes, I saw that. And I was like, Taylor gave an interview to Billboard?
No, she did not give an interview to Billboard. She wrote an Instagram caption and she said, I think she said, I couldn't have asked for a better 2017.
Yeah, that's maybe not the thing to say.
And, you know, taken out of context and put into a tweet that seemed to enrage some people that I follow or adjacent to the people that I follow.
Shout.
So, you know, I think it has a lot to do with, you know, her various sort of stumbles in terms of what you might call white feminism, going back to her beef with Nicki Minaj over the VMAs in the Bad Blood era.
But that might be why she's silent now about politics in 2017.
I think
she's decided to maintain complete radio silence.
Right. I think it was a big buildup of sort of resistance to her ubiquity and sort of moralizing. You know, the 1989 tour had a real like girl power vibe. There were all those videos from her friends talking about, you know, how tight they were and how good of a role model she was and whatever. And I think, you know, when people wanted her to sort of go one step further and put her money where her mouth was, as it were, like, you know, it was just ripe for an explosion.
I think it's also appropriate to talk about what happened to Katy Perry, because Katy Perry actually did the thing that I think people are asking Taylor Swift to do.
Yeah, she tried. Yeah.
Katy Perry both, number one, made like woke pop music, ostensibly woke pop music.
For a moment.
We'll play a clip of the song. I can't even think of it.
Chain to the Rhythm.
Thank you. We'll play that.
Will we?
Yeah, sure. Let's play some Chain to the Rhythm.
Are we crazy?
So Katy Perry, you know, theoretically either catching a wave or sensing the actual urgency of the moment, I don't know which, we can only speculate, but released woke pop, which was not very good.
Appeared with Hillary Clinton,
was vocal in her...
Ish?
For someone of her stature, was relatively vocal.
No, she took a side. She clearly took a
yes,
side.
Yes. And what did it get her?
Ridicule.
Scorn. And maybe Taylor... Watching that, now Taylor is like a far more astute manager of her public perception than Katy Perry ever has been or could be. But maybe Taylor seeing that felt like it was not a win for her.
I understand the visceral emotion of people who, you know, see someone, especially someone they believe to be profiting off of the idea of feminism or, you know, female solidarity, then not speaking out against more obvious injustices, especially racial ones. You know, she spent a long time this year and last beefing with a prominent black man who,
yes,
let us not forget, also stood next to Donald Trump. So, you know, it's complicated, but You know, I think I'll just say, like, be careful what you wish for. I don't think we want our famous people to be our politicians.
I tend to agree, but I also think that being a famous person, you're going to, like, Taylor has not sat for an interview in 2017.
That's
even
true.
The time she was on the cover of Time magazine as part of their Silence Breakers Person of the Year issue, she did not sit.
She answered questions in writing.
Yes. She was on the cover of British Vogue, and she wrote a poem.
A poem.
Shouts to poetry, though.
Yeah, a poem.
I will actually, any of our listeners who are poets, I know Hanif, friend of the podcast, Hanif assessed some of the technical merits of Taylor Swift's poem. On Twitter, but I would love to hear more technical analysis of this poem. So if you want to email us at podcast@nytimes.com, I'll be sure to share these thoughts with the world.
Let us know if Taylor Swift is a good poet.
So, yes,
but Taylor Swift is basically invoking the Miranda rule.
Yes.
That's what she's doing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. She's choosing to remain
silent. She doesn't want anything held against her. All she's doing.
She's going to do an interview at some point. Unless she's going to fool Beyonce, she's going to do an interview at some point, and it's going to have to come up. And Taylor is too famous to not have a good answer. I'm not saying I know what the good answer is, but she's too famous and too public and relied upon by too many people to not have a good answer.
But I feel this about a lot of people, and I'm consistently, you know, surprised. You know, yeah. Selena Gomez recently had a controversy where she was asked about acting in a Woody Allen movie for her Billboard Woman of the Year cover or whatever, and she didn't have an answer that was satisfying to most or any people. You know, it's a really hard time to be a human. I think celebrities should do better, but I also worry about asking them to do anything that we should be doing for ourselves as citizens.
Yeah, I think that's fair, but I also think, like, part of being a celebrity is knowing you're going to be in the public eye and, like, understanding some of the responsibilities that
study
come with
up.
It. And also being and understanding you're going to take an L if you're going to get it wrong. Taking L is part of the job. So a sort of corollary question comes from Adam Beezer. Adam says, it seems to me like a lot of the music this year reacted to the political climate in a visceral or emotional way. Do you expect that next year, as artists have more time to really process things, we will see more overtly political music? And is this something that we even want? So I recently interviewed Pharrell about the new NERD record. And the NERD record, there's some anti-Trump stuff on there. There's a lot of sort of, you can say, not necessarily straight Black Lives Matter influence material, but post 2015 police brutality, police killings of unarmed Black men. This is all stuff that is brought to bear in Pharrell's lyrics and also in the kind of nervous, fragmented energy of the album. And Pharrell is not someone who we've ever necessarily really thought about in political terms. So to see him
until that song from Minions or whatever,
Despicable Me 3.
Actually, on the first Nerd album, he has a song about Congress being
politicians
corrupt.
Sounding like strippers to me.
Right. That made it in your piece.
That did make it in my piece, and also maybe in 2017 is more true than ever. Oh, but to hear him talking about it so openly and in the interview with such heart lets me know that we are at a very different moment culturally than we were 2 to 5 years ago. You think also the recent Tribe Called Quest album and the sort of intense cultural and social politics embedded in that.
The Eminem album has an American flag on the cover. I believe.
I don't know her. More on Eminem next week.
That was a joke.
Still more on Eminem next week. JP, what's your vibe on this? Do you think more of this is coming? And do you think that almost the more that there is, it kind of devalues the potential impact?
That sounded like a leading question.
Damn, you sound like me listening to my own interviews and being like, why did I do that? Just walked you right to, held your hand right down the path. Anyway, JP, answer that however you want to.
I mean, it's hard to make political music that's not topical and disposable. It's been hard through the centuries to do this. A lot of protest songs are very vague and open-ended. And
those are the timeless ones?
And those are the timeless ones. If you're letting Donald Trump occupy your mind space and writing another anti-Trump song, what good is that? Because people who are against him are already against him. You're preaching to the choir. I long for political music that changed minds, changed hearts, convinced people to think a different way. And there's never much of that. But you don't know where it's going to come from either. I mean, I would love to hear a better song than Brad Paisley came up with in Country. Oof. You know, I would love to hear something from there. And maybe somebody will.
And better song than Joyner Lucas's I'm Not Racist.
Yeah, actually, I was moved.
By Joyner Lucas's I'm Not Racist. By Joyner Lucas's
I'm Not Racist. No. I was surprised, I'll say, by the I don't know if you listened to the new Dreezy song featuring Black, a.k.a. Six Lack, and Kodak Black have a song called Spar, which is a anti-Donald Trump song with an animated video. It's not a bad song. Kodak Black is an accused rapist, so it's problematic in its own way, but you know, it's not a bad song.
Hey man, I like the death for the song, you know what I'm saying? Not the death for the song, but the depth of the song. You feel me? The complexity. Bitch, I like the topic.
Is bond is fuck. My life is hard enough. They not rewarding us. They disregarding us. And if I go to DC, I'm trying to spar with Trump. I'm not a politician. Just can't ignore the stuff. This really just a free verse. I put my life in reverse. I dug up all my old pain and put it on a t-shirt. So many sides to this shit. Not here for popular shit. Your own people will laugh when you want positive shit. Before I die, I'ma teach. I light a blunt and I preach. Ain't no facade you can see that I can only be me. I got a daughter to raise. One day she gon' be a queen. I'm tryna get this shit together so she can have anything. My word is bond is off. My life is hard enough. They ain't rewarding us. They disregarding us. And if I go to DC, I'm tryna spar with Trump. I ain't a politician. Just can't ignore the stuff.
What we need is a political song that works like a meme.
Ooh.
The Black Beatles of politics.
Wow. Get pizza slime on that? Pizza slime working for the DNC? Is that going to happen? What would that... So do you
I
think...
I don't know. Maybe it would be like a 30-second song with like the most irresistible hook in the universe.
Oh, well, here's a good example of that, right? Which is All Right, the Kendrick Lamar song. When that became the sort of rallying cry of a few years ago and of the Black Lives Matter movement, it wasn't necessarily designed that way. You know, there's some lines in there that hinted in that direction, but it sort of took on a life of its own.
Yeah, I mean, there may be an accidental political song that just grabs people.
New question. This is coming in from Julia Frakes, friend of the podcast. Julia came in with the wild 10-question long form. So we're gonna pick one or maybe two. Here's an interesting one.
One of the best podcast listeners in terms of engagement.
Yes, very dedicated. Y'all can learn a lot from her. Just want y'all to know. What is the state of alternative music in 2017?
Alternative rock?
I think that's what we're going for. Alternative rock. What is the state of alternative rock?
You know, we made a big interactive slideshow and playlist that I would say spoke pretty well to the fact that alternative rock is alive and well if your lead singer or songwriter is not a man.
Yes.
Check that out. Rock's not dead.
Also, but what about in the mainstream? What about your Imagine Dragons's, your Portugal the Man's's? Who's Portugal the Man's?
It's really bleak. You know, John and I did this the other day, I think, but we looked at the alternative rock chart.
Ooh, let's do that.
I'm going to
pull it up. Oh, it's good times.
Very strange.
Yo.
It's very strange.
Dramatic reading of the Billboard alternative. Was it the alternative rock or the hard rock chart?
Both, but let's go alternative, the alternative songs chart.
All right, speak on it.
Beck, Up All Night is number one.
Never heard of him.
JP, is that a good song?
Yeah. I'll go for it. It's catchy.
Number two, Walk on Water by 30 Seconds to Mars. Number three, Feel It Still by Portugal the Man, one of the surprise pop hits of the year.
Let's listen to a little bit of that just because people won't know what it is. You probably don't know what it is.
But you know what it is.
You know what it is. So here's 7 seconds of that song. Just enough.
Ooh, I'm a rebel just for kicks. Yeah, your lover's an abyss for my heart to eclipse now. Might be over now, but I feel it still.
Number four, Lay It On Me, Vance Joy, who is a man who exists.
Shrug.
Thunder by Imagine Dragons, another surprise pop hit of the year. Angela by The Lumineers. One Foot by Walk the Moon. No Roots by Alice Merton. The Sky is a Neighborhood by Foo Fighters. Again, this is not a strong crop of
songs. Not even out of the top 10 yet.
You want me to keep going?
Yeah, go down to like 16 or 18.
Sober Up, AJR featuring Rivers Cuomo. You got some more Imagine Dragons, some Cold War Kids.
Oh, some AWOL Nation.
AWOL Nation, more Portugal the Man,
I
more Imagine Dragons.
I kind of secretly want to do an AWOL Nation feature.
It's all yours.
I think also in the world, yes. Not just at the New York Times. It's probably online in the world.
You're
aligned with the alternative rock chart.
Yeah, I have to say these bands are not making an impact culturally in the zeitgeist, in my opinion.
No, although shouts to all my bands on the cover of Alternative Press. I want you to know that I see you in 2018. I've been seeing you, but I especially see you. And your man's J. Roddy Walston and The Business are up in here. Moon Taxi.
But presumably,
let's
hope that these bands can make a living on the road, yes, and keep playing.
Yeah, you know, I wish them all the best.
You don't need millions of streams if you can, you know, tour 1,000-seat clubs and keep going.
I will say, I think better alternative music is being made to the left of alternative rock radio.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Now, obviously, there's a million reasons, but why is alternative rock radio not playing actually good alternative rock? That's what sort of, like, why is it still playing this?
Voices?
Yes. I also think a lot about...
That chart tells you that.
Okay, this is maybe a little abstract, but, like, work with me. So, rivers carve their way through, you know, land or stone or whatever, and they create a space.
I thought you were talking about Rivers Cuomo for a second. Water, bodies of water.
Yeah, they're carving paths for themselves. And at a certain point, the water stops flowing, but the path remains.
Bring this home.
Okay, I'm bringing this home. So the path remains. And I think what you see in the sort of like alternative rock of this particular time period is a bunch of people trying to walk in the path of a formerly grand genre.
The 90s, basically.
Yes. And so you have music that is stylistically analogous to that music. And then you also have fans that are kind of holdover fans from that time who want something. And a lot of their old favorite bands aren't necessarily existing or touring or making new records. And so you have these new bands that are sort of filling in the image and the ideology. It's a Xerox of what used to be, but that river path exists. And it's all someone needs to do. They don't need to carve a new path. They just need to walk a path that already exists. That's how I feel about a lot of these bands right now and this particular genre and space.
And that's why I think the innovation is coming from the underground. The innovation is in, you know, these female musicians that we covered in Vagabond and Snail Mail and Phoebe Bridgers, who we talked about last week. You mm-hmm. know, if those women were being played on alternative rock radio, I think the world would be a better place.
And just also shout out to Adelita's Way, number 37 on Billboard Hot Mainstream Rock Tracks right now. Shout out to them.
I will say that New York City now has an alternative rock radio station for the first time in many
years. Have you
listened
to it? I haven't listened to it.
You know, it's a lot of Foo Fighters.
That sucks. Sorry. Objectively, that sucks.
And a lot of Imagine Dragons. And a lot of Imagine Dragons, as Pedro, our producer, says.
Also objectively sucks. JP, what do you got on this?
Maybe these bands aren't making music for radio. They're making
the
music.
Cool bands.
Yeah, the good
ones
bands.
The ones we like. But like at a certain point, if you're sort of maybe a savvy radio programmer, wouldn't you think, hey, this would be a great opportunity to kind of like
to find a proto martyr song that we can put on the air?
Yes. Or something by any woman.
Yeah.
Any woman. Literally any woman.
But testing and all the things they do with radio, all the research they do with radio,
it's
completely...
Is there going to be a tomatoes in rock radio problem, just like there was a tomatoes in country radio problem? I don't know, man. Anyway, that's what we think about alternative rock. Here's another genre-specific question, and I think, JP, this is probably mostly targeted to you.
Uh-oh.
Although I'm...
Pop quiz.
I would like to think I have something to say, but probably not as much. This is from Zahir Arif, who has a very cool Gmail address that I'm not going to say, but it's fire Gmail address. I was wondering what your thoughts are on experimental music. it seems like in the past 5 years, the most exciting music I've heard is from artists like Arca, 10 Tricks Point Never, Prurient, Rabbit, and Andy Stott. It's also been refreshing to note the rise of incredibly talented female artists in the world of electronic music, which is almost a parallel trend to the one you've noted in punk rock recently. Women like Fatima Al-Qadri, Holly Herndon, Kelly Lee Omens, Pharmacon, and Seb Deliza are creating challenging music that bravely transcends genre in many ways. I've heard theories that this is due to the computer replacing the guitar as a folk instrument, but I'd like to hear your take.
Zahir, were you at Moog Fest with me this year?
I don't know. Zahir, were you at Moog Fest? Definitely going to be there next year.
Moog Fest next year is an entire lineup of non-binary female transgender artists,
right,
which sounds
right
off
up
the hook.
Right up the alley.
But it's true. It is great stuff. To me, it's great stuff to experience live.
What does it do live?
Well, it takes you to strange perceptual spaces.
Mm-hmm.
You can do things.
It's like LSD.
a little bit.
Not that I would know.
You can do things with visuals. I mean, it's the spectacle in the moment. A lot of the records are really good, too, but you have to sort of not have attention deficit disorder and really focus in on them. But experimental. I mean, it's the research and development arm. This stuff is then going to get sampled by Kanye West next Thursday.
That's interesting.
Feed back into hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is really exciting. The place to consume it, though, to me, is mostly live.
Do you think women are faring better proportionately in this space than they are in other spaces?
I think people in this space feel the obligation to be more open-minded than they do, say, in heavy metal, hard rock.
Sure.
But also, the women are really fantastic.
The gender expectations are different walking in the door, you think?
Well, I mean, it depends, though, because, I mean, if you look at the big EDM festivals, it's guys, and Nicole Moudaber, you know, gets a stage.
Right.
Pardon me if I've mispronounced her name. She's really great. But in the experimental space, I think people are just listening to the music, which is what they should be doing in the first place.
Right. Okay, next question is actually more of a quick one, but a good one. So we'll just bring it up quickly. This is coming from Aaron Lickshine. Hi, guys. Long-time listener, big-time fan. Hey, thanks, Aaron. Was wondering if you can give the animatic Jai Paul, a much-needed podcast shout-out. Fair point. And lay on us some hot takes, insider info on his deal. To me, his MIA-ness since dropping BTSU is almost like Picasso dropping just Demoiselle d'Avignon, Jobs dropping just the OG iPod.
Wow.
And dare I say, Thug dropping just Slime Season 1 and nothing more.
Wow. Good question. Or comment, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
I mean, I love the leaked demos. I still listen to them.
Yep. That was on my best of whatever year
whatever
that
year
was.
Those demos leaked, yeah, or were leaked or whatever went on there.
You guys saw that he gave an interview?
Well, he's back. Like, he's back a little bit. Him and his brother.
Yes, they are producing for other artists, and they gave. They have a creative space in an old BBC studio, and they gave an interview to like some British real estate publication, the name of which escapes me. Maybe like Property News or something. It's the first Jai Paul interview maybe ever. And it's like two quotes in like a real estate newspaper, which is, of course, perfect. Doesn't anger me at all. Not like I've been trying for years. It's not like I've been trying. Okay, fine. Property News. I see you. But yes, they released two songs that were produced by the other brother or together?
I think together. AK Paul is the other brother. Yeah. And I think they work together on them. And they have some female vocalists on them, I believe. Also shout out the AK Paul song Land Cruisin' from maybe a year or two ago, which I still have on my iPhone and I put on a lot.
So shout out to Property Week for scooping me. Damn it, bastards. All right, we're going to close out with one more question. And it's, again, it's a question, a version of which came in from a bunch of different people. This is a question about Latin music. And this is coming from Gabe Duverge. 2017 felt like a massive year for Latin music and the grander pop music consciousness. This was the first year that we had real Latin artists playing on pop music stations out here in the Midwest, where there aren't a lot of dedicated Latin stations. Now, that's obviously a thing, not a problem in New York or LA or Miami or Texas, but in other places is going to be an issue. It finally feels like nationwide we're moving closer to a day where the average American pop music fan doesn't just mean Pitbull. Hey, when they say they like Latin music. Anyway, Mr. 305 takes exception to that. You guys touched briefly on the changes the Billboard charts could have a big negative impact on Latin music. Given these developments, do you think that 2018 will continue to see the emergence of real Latin music into the zeitgeist outside of tradition Latin culture centers? And Gabe is writing from Louisville, Kentucky.
Short answer, I hope so.
Yeah. Here's my instinct. I think we're about to see 6 to 12 months of kind of unlikely collaborations. I think Joe brought up earlier the Rockstar remix with Ozuna. I think you're going to see a lot more overt kind of a talk about gaming the system. People are going to try to game the Latin charts, and they're going to try to import the energy and passion of the Latin music fan base into the pop charts. So I do think that's something you're going to see more of. I don't think we've yet to see what I think is going to take to do the thing that you're talking about, Gabe, which is probably going to be the arrival of, say, a truly bilingual pop star who's genre flexible. I think at some point we will get to that, but I don't know if we're seeing that person. I think that will probably be the thing that does what you're talking about. That'd be my guess.
And we did have that the Ricky Martin, Shakira moment, what, a decade ago?
Yes.
And it didn't last.
Right.
Yeah, I was going to say, when Despacito, you know, sort of started to go down at the end of summer, started to stop being the, like, comet that it was, you know, I wrote a story where the executives in Latin music were very hopeful that the door had finally, you know, been stomped down for good. And, you know, there was still some skepticism of whether this moment would last. And I think it's already lasted some. I think it will be very interesting to see if Despacito comes away with a big award at the Grammys, whether that will be a sort of sea change moment. And I think, you know, as we've talked about, there is a crop of next generation stars that's, you know, we talked about Ozuna last
yes.
week. I think there is a very strong stable of young Latin talent.
Yeah, I mean, like J Balvin, yeah. Prince Royce, I mean,
Bad
yeah.
Bunny.
Yeah, and I think it has a shot to last, but it's gonna...
I do think language is to do the thing that I think Gabe was specifically asking about. I think language is an mm-hmm. issue, and I think I'd be interested to see if record labels, American record labels, are going to be interested in signing people who are fluent on both sides of the language divide. You know, you have someone, to me, the most pop-oriented Latin musicians, you know, your Ozunas, your Nicky Jams, speak English, but maybe not fluently. And I think probably to get the kind of like mainstream consistent presence, it will probably take a language barrier leap. More than it will take a genre leap.
Though I think they've been, you know, Latin artists that I've spoken to and that I've seen in the press this year have been very proud that the breakthroughs of this year
have been Spanish
have been
language.
In Spanish.
Completely agree. I think for it to go to Louisville and last, that's where I think probably.
That's when you need a Shakira.
And I want to say this is good for music, this is good for culture, this is good for politics. The more this gets mixed, the more this side of America is visible and audible across the entire country is a good thing.
Yeah, and I don't want to suggest that the importance of the breakthrough of having it happen in Spanish is somehow should be diminished or somehow be elided. I just think when I know how American radio works, I feel like it will be easier to break down those barriers when there's a fluidity going back and forth. One of the interesting things about doing the playlist every week is seeing on Spotify the number of songs that are happening that are crossover songs between Spanish-speaking artists and English-speaking artists. So let's actually go out on one of the many, many songs that have come up in the last 3 months that combine Spanish-speaking artists with English-speaking artists. And it's one that I like a lot that I've heard a bunch on the radio. And that is Reggaeton Lento, the remix, and that is CNCO or Cinco featuring Little CNCO. Or Cinco featuring Little Mix.
Boy, I can see the way you just move that body. I know it's crazy, but I feel like you could be the one that I've been chasing in my dreams. Boy, I can see you're looking at me like you want it. But usually I'm like, whatever, but tonight, the way you're moving got me where I'm by.
It started when I looked in her eyes, I got close and I'm like, my animals.
That's our podcast this week. I don't want to talk about the end of 2017 yet because we've still got some time to go, but I want to thank everybody for being such a dedicated listener, sharing your questions with us, sharing your feelings about pop music with us this year. We've had a blast doing this for you, and we'll keep doing it as long as we are allowed. So thank you for all your questions, and keep them coming at popcast@nytimes.com. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Subscribe to the podcast, please. Subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get your audio content: iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio app, etc., etc. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We are back next week.